You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Anna Kellis. Anna, it's good to have you here this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
And so, Anna, the question that we begin with, and some people wince at, is the big broad question of who are you? And by that, I'm just trying to get, how do we start this conversation? What's a snapshot of either the pieces of your life or the qualities of who you are that you would like for us to start with? And then we'll go into more depth over the course of the hour.
I know it's a broad question. It's one of those that I think people could either talk about for 7 hours or they don't really know how to even start the conversation.
Or they shut down after 5 seconds.
Right. I tend to be a longer winded talker, but we'll try and keep it from 7 hours. I would say I'm a very dedicated person. I'm from Trumansburg, which doesn't mean that I'm inherently dedicated, but it is.
But you're local.
It explains that I'm back here to some extent for me. I was there in the early 70s and left when I was 18. Studied at Binghamton, traveled the world in my own way, trying to find myself in my 20s, like I think a lot of people did. But I've always been very driven by justice, the sense of justice. And so when I look back at my life, even in my wanderings, when I was at Binghamton, president of my dorm and the head of the health food co-op and sang in a band and environmental studies major and captain of the ultimate frisbee team and did them all at the same time. And, very typical Anna fashion. South America, guide in the jungle, in the Amazon for a while, trying to teach people about ecology and then studied poverty and nutrition and really trying to understand food inequality in South America and its relationship really with a lot of the disease in young children, and just drawn to these things, the health of the planet and health of humanity, and the humility that it requires to heal some of those wounds. Some people would say I'm passionate and driven. I think that in this particular context, it's the first time where I feel like that's actually fully required and perfect fit to be very effective. I don't have to hold back on that kind of drive. Mm-hmm. And I think that it could be really helpful to represent people. So I think people get a sense of me that way.
Right. And you are in a race for the second district.
Yes,
for county legislature. So you brought some music with you. And we're going to start with your first piece, which is Travis Knapp and I Will. Do you want to say anything before it or after it?
I can just present this by saying Travis Knapp is one of my closest friends. And he's, I think, one of the most genuine human beings I've ever met, with a person of tremendous integrity. And his music shows through this. He's written all the music. He plays the banjo, plays the keyboards. He went to IC. So anybody who has an opportunity to see him, their hearts will be lifted. So that's why I brought this song.
Here we go.
Oh, inside. You remember why you came. You remember all your pride. It's a smile from a stranger. It's a present from a child. Letter from an old friend, or a moment in the wild. I will stand up and I will be strong, and I will give my life to know I'm loved. I'll give my soul and I'll give my song, and I'll give everything to share this love. Remember you are found, then pass the feeling on. I will stand up and I will be strong, and I will give my life to know I'm loved. I'll give my soul and I'll give my song, and I'll give everything to share this love. I'll trust the
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Anna Kellis. Anna, let's go to what are the experiences, or what experience, if there was a major one, or what experiences have kind of conspired to wisen you, to kind of get you from not necessarily knowing what mattered, but to knowing what mattered. How has your life been shaped by some formative experiences? Because you described a lot of different kinds of work and a lot of different kinds of roles, but where did the light bulbs go off?
It's a really, really good question. When you know, I could talk about all the things, my teenage years or my... my adult life, you know, when I'm like a conscious, critical person because I've engaged with the world a lot. But, you know, I feel like when people ask these questions, you should go with the first vision that you had.
Yeah. And that's generally in a sense, the truest one.
Yeah. So, I remember I was watching a movie. Well, I wasn't. My dad was watching a movie. And it was one of those moments where I felt like, you know, I look back at the little kid, I was maybe 5 or 6, and I don't want to protect her and say, oh, don't watch that. That was, your heart broke. Don't watch that. But at the same time, when you ask me something of an earliest memory, that's one of the most formidable things in my life. It was a movie about a young man who was an athlete, and he was American, but his family was German. And it was during World War II. I think his father had been from Germany, but he was born and raised in the United States. And they went to Germany for a race, and the German government didn't want them to leave. So after the race, I think he was kidnapped, and he was thrown into a prison in this tiny room with a lot of people, and they dragged him out after starving him for a couple days and were trying to force him to run for the Germans. And so there were scenes of torture and, you know, trying to break him down to reprogram him to, you know, support and be an icon for the Germans. And I don't remember how it ended. I just remember the scene where he was like sitting on a tile floor, bathroom floor, after being beaten up and, you know, sort of the blood trickling down his face. And there was something about resolve. There was something about integrity. And I remember going to bed that night, and I had these horrible nightmares, and I woke up screaming like, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be here. This world is too hard. I think I was like 5 or 6.
Right.
And I remember my mother holding me and saying, you know, this is a choice. We come here, you know, and we can hold that purity in our heart. And there's something about fighting for that kind of integrity and that kind of justice that became a real driver in the way that I have related to my life and related to people in my life.
Right. Right. And it's a powerful story. And I want to just, you were 5 when that happened, the way you brought it up. And, what did you learn about integrity and justice, and as well as what did you learn about the fight? Because there are two different kinds of lessons that come out of us, out of that, the horror of the fight, but also the nature of integrity and justice.
Yeah. So, you know, the minute you say that, another story that came to mind, I remember when I was in middle school, maybe, you know, fifth grade maybe. And there was a bully, you know, we were playing after school and we were playing King of the Hill. And there was this one bully at the top of the hill, and he kept pushing everybody down. And I remember, I was just so mad at this, right? Mm-hmm. And I finally pushed him off the hill so that we could all be on the hill together. Mm-hmm. And then I remember after the game, I was leaning over a fence, and he was so mad at me that he threw me over the fence and knocked the wind out of me. And it ended up being this, big, with parents had to come in. And I remember when I went home that night, and I was so mad, you know, after, mm-hmm. I was just so mad. And my dad said to me, well, what did you do wrong? And I was so pissed off, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not really like reflecting this. And he wasn't saying it was my fault, but he was saying in every situation, we bring something of ourselves that led us to manifest what happened. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the ability to be conscious of that. What did you bring to the table? No matter what. Mm-hmm. What did you bring to the table? And throughout my whole like growing up period, it was always that same question in every situation. Like, what did you bring to the table? And I think that as I'm now an adult looking back, and what that has instilled in my core nature is that you always have a part to play.
Right.
And in that, there's humility.
What did you learn at that 10 or 11 year, what did you say to your, do you remember how you responded to your dad?
Oh, I remember at first saying, what do you mean? He pushed me over the fence. How could I have done something? I was looking the other way. But what I came to after that, when I sat with it, because he asked me questions, like he made me come to it. Mm-hmm. And what I realized is that I shamed him.
Yeah.
And that isn't a good feeling for anyone.
Right, right. And it's your stories bring to mind a couple of stories. And one was when I was maybe in fourth or fifth grade, which would have been about 10 or 11 years old. It because there was a fair amount of bullying, and I was kind of a non-traditional boy in some ways. And this was the late 60s, mid to late 60s. And I learned that I figured out I don't have to win this fight, but I have to figure out how to stop it. So mm-hmm. my job isn't to win it, it's to end it. Mm-hmm. And if you don't want to win it, then you have to fight in a very different way. And I've spent the whole rest of my life trying to figure out how can you be forceful enough to end something without winning and shaming the opposition.
So I tell you another story. Because I'm somehow full of them by everything that you're bringing up. This is another childhood story. So I was at the grocery store and I really wanted a pack of gum. No, and all these childhood memories are coming up. I was again like 7. And my mom wouldn't let me have the pack of gum. And so you don't know right or wrong when you're a little kid. And I took the pack of gum. Mm-hmm. And you know, most kids, I have no idea, most kids. All I can say is, for me, I had my sisters. I had gum. I'm sitting in the back. I'm not going to eat it by myself and not give it to my mm-hmm, sisters. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. I'm in the back, like, half for my sister, half for me, half for my sister. My mother looks in the back mirror. She's like, oh, my God, you're not allowed to take gum.
Right.
She, you know, stops the car. She brings me back. And makes me return the gum and apologize, and you know, asks me afterwards what did I learn, and I, you know, my instinct is not to get caught next time, right?
Right, which is so everybody's instinct.
Right. Well, I'm like such a little kid. You don't know. But then she tells the story, and she said, I realized I couldn't get at you that way. Like I couldn't explain it to you that way. But I knew you had this unbreakable, huge heart for everyone and never wanted to hurt anything. And she said, you know, the woman who was working at the counter, like that money might come out of her paycheck and that might hurt her. Like that's stealing from people who've been trying to build us this place so that we have a place to buy food. And I just started crying. Like then I knew I was hurting someone mm-hmm. and that was like repugnant to me as this little kid. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, just getting at the heart space. And so when you're in conflict, that ability to put yourself in the other person's shoes, no matter what, mm-hmm. and then speak from that place, is powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had a clinical chaplaincy supervisor who, told a story where he learned about morality, which is the other side of the story you told, which your mother didn't choose to go with you on. But he was told to go down, and this was in the Depression, and there was no money and there was no food, and he was told to go and get some food, and he was told to go and steal food, but he did it in such a way that they knew he was taking food and they just winked and passed. Yeah. And that's a way to fight an institutional battle where you can't honor the law, but you can't also just flagrantly break it.
Right.
And we don't learn those kinds of subtle lessons very good. Your mother was trying to teach it to you from one way, and he was trying to show it
yeah.
to me as from the other side, as a young chaplain in training. Those are really, really powerful stories.
Yeah, yeah. You bring the humanity back to it.
Right.
And whenever you touch on that, I think that it allows people to consciously engage each other.
And to be kind.
Mm-hmm.
For example, you know, restraining an out-of-control person physically allows them to calm down
mm.
so that you can then engage with more kindness. It's a very forceful thing to do, but if you're not trying to beat them up or harm them, it's a similar kind of lesson is what I'm trying to
You know, it's
show.
Funny you should say that. People will laugh at me sometimes about, laugh with me, maybe I hope. I hug everyone I see. You know, it's very, when I went down, I lived in South America for 4 years, and they would say, tienes sangre de Latina, because it's
the
not
way you
very,
were physically kind of,
yeah, 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 you know, it, yeah. Very affectionate in that way. And my godparents said, you know, because I'm legally blind, I adopted that as a little kid because I didn't know where my body ended and others began. So
right.
I would just run and hug everybody. But actually, also, it's a way of, you know, when you connect And there is that constraint. You're like, oh, this is you, this is me, mm-hmm. you know, we're connected. It's an unconscious thing, but only when you just said it did I realize there's something about it that's saying, that feels like safe. This is a safety thing. And right. then you can connect with someone in a real way. And I'm wondering, I have to reflect on that. Maybe there is something about that.
I think it strikes me in two different ways, and one of them is that it is a safety thing when you can touch and not be scared, mm-hmm. And when we have a culture or rituals that allow us to communicate physically. We don't have those in where we are here in the U.S. in this particular
culturally,
time frame.
No.
Culturally, we don't have these rituals of introducing and meeting and greeting and partying and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I like to talk about is we need to be able to assess things. They need to be assess them for intellectual accuracy, emotional honesty, and whether they're physically or sensorily engaging or compelling. And you have described communicating in that physically or sensorily engaged. And a lot of people don't do that. But until we're human critters, we are animals, and we need to communicate on all three levels. So it can't just be rational, intellectual. It can't just be emotional, or it can't just be physical.
Absolutely.
We need to bring it together, and that's kind of what you described, which it's one of the best examples of it that I've heard as I've tried to raise that issue on this show in the past.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's really important, and I'm glad you brought in all three pieces, because I find that in my own search to be a good communicator, it can't be unbalanced, because some people feel safe in some realms and not in other realms. Mm-hmm. And if you only have one tool of the three of them, then it does limit you as a communicator. So meeting people where they are. So if someone is a very, you know, rational, you show me the facts.
We live in an academic town.
Right. Well, and I am an academic, right? So part of being an academic, part of going through a PhD program, is to learn the material. But actually, part of going through a PhD program and surviving a PhD program is learning how to speak articulately, mm-hmm. And to be able to parse out cause and effect, mm-hmm. The chronology of thoughts, mm-hmm. leading to some conclusion, and be able to articulate those steps along the way to some conclusion. And that ability is helps people relate on that intellectual level. Mm-hmm. And if you can bring both simultaneously, then people can feel comfortable in themselves in your physical presence, mm-hmm. and relate to you psychologically and intellectually. So it's an art for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. How did you decide to go on the route of a PhD? Why a PhD?
I was that kid that did jigsaw puzzles, you know, until 2 or 3 in the morning. I was that kid who always asked why, you know, I can't just memorize. And in fact, I had a really hard time in school. I did extremely well, but it took me, I feel like, 5 times longer. Mm-hmm, and I was up mm-hmm. because I couldn't ever memorize. But the minute the big picture clicked, like the minute I always looked, okay, so there's this pathway in biochemistry, but then why is that, and what's the mm-hmm. context around that, and the minute I could visualize it in my head, then I owned it, then it became part of my understanding viscerally, and mm-hmm. then I could teach it, and then then it would bring my emotions in, and I would get excited about it. And so, you know, if you look back on my freshman biology book, and you'll see in like the sidelines, I've gone back and looked, and the mm-hmm. parts that are highlighted, and it says, cool, excellent, that's awesome, you know, which is a ridiculous thing to see in someone's textbook, right? So, it says a lot about me. Well, so, yes,
you're having an emotional relationship with intellectual material.
Exactly.
And we do.
Right. And one thing that I found in academia as an undergrad is that I wanted the Socratic experience. I wanted to have the experience where I was with people that knew the material so well, and they were being paid for. They were seeking money, finding money so that they could sit and find the truth. Mm-hmm. You know, that actually was what was wanted of them. Mm-hmm. Then we could have that experience where we truly sought that. And I've found that sometimes in academia, and I've found that sometimes not to be. But I have had the occasional experience where, you know, in the hallway with my PhD colleagues, you know, we were trying to understand truly the causality of something. And
what's the topic area of your doctoral work?
The thesis of my PhD, I was looking, my area was nutrition and nutritional mm-hmm. epidemiology. So epidemiology is using statistical analysis to evaluate the association or the causality,
if
the relationship,
close, yeah.
Yeah, between risk factors and disease outcomes in the context of nutrition. So mm-hmm. I specifically started looking at a data set in Russia and published my first paper on some of the eating patterns during economic crises in Russia from 92 to 98, where they had some privatization in 92 and an economic crisis in 98, and looking at the impact on high-income and low-income children, mm-hmm. Families, and looking at the children's diets. And my dissertation work was looking at the impact of urbanization, of the built environment's mm-hmm. change over time on obesogenic behavior patterns between mothers and children in the Philippines. So intergenerational responses to changes in the built environment and mm-hmm. its impact on health. Yep. So it was an amazing experience. Mm-hmm. It kind of also makes sense, given that I am so passionate about environmental issues mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and human health and human well-being issues, it tied both of those together for me.
Neat, neat, neat. Now, we're going to take a break for music now. We're going to play Roadman.
John Petronzio, yeah, who he actually is the keyboardist for John Brown's Body,
yeah.
And this is his solo project, and it's currently being considered for a Grammy. So I encourage everybody to get to know his music as soon as possible, because he might not be here for that much longer. But he is—he's one of ours, and the song is called "Who Do You Love," and it's just an exceptionally beautiful song.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Anna Kellis. So, Anna,
yeah.
Tell me, what do you feel is the most important, and I would say by importance, I would say the most polarizing issue locally, the one that we're having the most trouble getting our heads around, hearts around, and everything else around. We live in a time where extreme partisan conflict is kind of putting us in this position of being in a circular firing squad, where we're taking each other out, we're bullying each other in the public realm. We do that less so here in Ithaca at this particular moment than we did 25 years ago in the late 80s and early 90s when it was extremely fraught and people would hide rather than speak up in public. We've kind of gotten past that as a community, but we're still, you know, so where what are the issues that you see locally, and then we'll talk a little bit about how can you address the various sides of these issues.
Such a good question. There are two veins, I think, that are intertwined. I think that in this town and in this country, we're still fighting our way through segregation and race issues in this town, just like any other town. And there are some things that are happening here that I'm very proud of. In this town, there are conversations happening. There are people in the people of color and in the white community that are actively trying to create healing.
Mm-hmm.
What I see right now is that we have physical segregation. You know, we have South Side, we have North Side neighborhoods. There are a significantly higher amount of people of color. And we have areas like Fall Creek and Bell Sherman that are significantly, and other neighborhoods, I'm just pointing out a few, that are higher white communities, just by numbers. And so there's physical segregation. And then one of the things that I think is exacerbating, and I read an article two or three weeks ago, we talk about the built environment here and that we don't have enough housing. And specifically, we're not building affordable housing and we're not building senior housing as much, and we're not building homeowner options. We're building a lot of rentals. And then who does this impact? And one of the things that we're seeing is that there's a greater outflow of people of color and lower income groups than middle income and more of the white mm-hmm. community. And I think that is an issue. And this is not 100%. You know, when I'm walking around Fall Creek, and I just point this out, is that it's a little heartbreaking. There are so many people, at least every day there's one family that says, I am actively looking to move out of Fall Creek because I can't afford the taxes on my home anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's affecting the middle income mm-hmm. families as well. Mm-hmm. So this is not a black and white issue, but when I say black and white, I just mean, you know, it's not cut and dry.
Not clear, yeah.
But I do feel that this is something that we need to continue to work on. And I'm going to share one example where the two intertwine mm-hmm. and we need some healing around mm-hmm. this. There was the Hancock Project, and it's, you know, project of affordable housing. Mm-hmm. And there are, there's, you know, polarization that's happening on this. And there was one particular incident that I'm aware of that I've been processing and thinking through, and I've talked to people about, that people from the community went to one of the planning board meetings, and they were, you know, talking about how they felt that it was inappropriate height, that they shouldn't get the mm-hmm. variance, that they liked the townhouses but not the one massive, you know, dormitory style building. And there was a tension building and building and building, and some of the comments a week before had been borderline not okay, or maybe not conscious,
right,
as far as awareness of structural racism. And there are certainly some people in that group, you know, that exist.
Mm-hmm.
But that particular week, you know, they weren't there. And there was a comment, you know, from the planning board of, well, you know, this is structural racism and we need to create this. And it created a wound.
Mm-hmm.
And because some of the people took that as, I'm not racist.
Right.
And I, you know, and so then there's this education that needs to happen mm-hmm. of, of what is racism, and what I, when I took the race and racism talking circles, mm-hmm. when I was a part of that, mm-hmm. and I learned about, again, that visceral connection sure. to what is structural racism, then I realized that just by being passive, I was part of the problem, you know, and, right. and so that actively seeking to create a built environment where we can all live together so it becomes less of an us versus them, your neighborhood, my neighborhood, but still respecting mm-hmm. that everyone needs to be at the table so that everybody can stay living there. I mean, there's some right. people who've now moved because, you know, the construction or the, you know, right. for various right. reasons. Right. So it has to work for everybody.
Yeah. And it has to work for everybody. And it's an extremely complicated situation because in the last 50 or 60 years, we've nearly doubled in population. We're the only county in Tompkins in upstate New York that's doubled its population. Our African-American population has increased fivefold. Our Asian population has grown from nothing to 9% of the population. And Latino population has increased to just slightly less than the African-American population. But we're still... demographically, we're as white as the state of Kansas. Mm-hmm. We are 79% white, mm-hmm. Non-Latino. And those we haven't come to terms, while we've gone from being 98% white to 79% white in these 50, 60, 70 years,
right.
we have not really adjusted. We also haven't come to terms with the fact that over half of the African American population doesn't live in the city of Ithaca
exactly.
and hasn't for over 20 years.
Exactly.
We haven't gotten used to the fact that when we passed anti-development ordinances back in the mid-1980s, that now between a quarter and a third of our permanent workforce comes in from the outside, and with every two new jobs, it goes to somebody who has to live outside.
Right.
Because they can't afford. So the issues are huge. How do you get people to understand that we have institutionalized the hollowing out of the middle class locally, so people are commuting in from 20, 30 miles away for $10 to $18 an hour jobs.
Right.
That's an incredible expense for them, and it means they don't get to be with their kids when they're in school program or need to be for the school meetings or whatever. How do we right-size our perception of who we are?
Right. Yeah, I think it's really hard. I mean, the first thing anybody who works in conflict resolution knows is that everybody needs to come to the table. And right now, I don't even think that's, we've gotten there yet.
Okay.
So, you know, one of the things that I've been talking about, and I really, really believe this, is that people feel first safe creating a voice amongst the people they feel are their family, mm-hmm. right? So that's where you can first practice your voice.
Yeah.
And then when you build that confidence, then you can start increasing, you know, the strength behind your voice and the confidence, right? So one of the things that I've been talking about, and I believe this really strongly, are the neighborhood associations. And so in that context, you know, people can talk amongst themselves mm-hmm. in a place, congregating in a place that they feel comfortable, finding people to represent them that are in their neighborhood. And then from that place, they can create a voice for themselves, and then you can create a coalition of neighborhood associations that every area, every neighborhood has a voice. And I feel like it creates a checks and balances with our government.
Right.
It's one small piece.
Right. And what I would like to explore with you, because when we're doing organizing, we tend to end up with an institutionalized position, which becomes the dominant or the dominating position. And how can these neighbors, because my guess is that we are going to have profound differences of opinion and profound differences in needs going forward. And so the neighborhoods are going to have to deal with complexity in a way we haven't dealt with the complexity
Absolutely.
In public life. How do you see helping to bring... bring us all along with greater respect for peoples whose needs and whose values differ from our own?
Well,
so they can get them built into the environment.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, I think that first I have to say that it's not me that's going to do it.
What are your thoughts on how to do it?
Yeah, no, and I wanted to hold that because because this might not, you know, be the only solution. It's just what's in my heart, you know, right. And so it's something that I would love to see explored.
Sure.
But what I've experienced is that it works whenever you bring people together that are going to be addressing emotionally charged issues. It's really good to have experts in the room who are conflict resolution, people who have training in conflict resolution, and people who have training in active listening and counseling in those ways. And we forget that piece. We think, you know, well, we can all come into the room and as long as we all are talking and as long as we are all here, you know, we'll come to some solution, or at least we'll be heard. And actually, that's not always the case.
Right. And you've highlighted a really serious problem. Mm-hmm. And that people, you can't just, when I was an undergraduate at Cornell, I tried to organize an interfaith dialogue in 1979 or 80, and Jews, Christians, and secular Muslims, non-religious people, we tried to come together and talk, but we were so unknowing of the diversity of our own traditions and how we'd impacted each other that we couldn't even begin those sorts of conversations. So we needed to learn a good bit before we could even have a meaningful conversation. We didn't devolve into yelling matches, which right. sometimes happens, as you talk about. The risk on the other side is our professionalization of relationships means that we don't know how to explore or take risks in ways that are more organic, and we become dependent on professionals who set a way of talking about things that becomes normative rather than responsive to people's needs. And so my concern with your proposed solution is that we need to do some of both, but the most important thing is for people to just learn how to start close and then take risks with people further away.
Right. And I've seen that. I've seen this work, and I've seen it not work. I've seen not work when the conflict resolution person is dictating a formula. I've seen it work when there's guidelines of this is what we see as respect, and now go. You know, and also prioritizing listening.
Right.
That it's actually more broad guidelines, but that conversation at the very beginning saying, let's all come from the place that we don't know the other person's life, and we don't know what they've experienced, and we don't know why they have the perspectives they have, and come with a beginner's mind.
Right.
I mean, listen.
Right. And I would take it one step further. It's not just a beginner's mind, but it's genuine curiosity.
Absolutely.
An open heart as much as an open mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
And sometimes sharing food, having that physical contact makes it a little easier, or it gets in the way.
Sharing food is great.
It depends. It kind of, food is a symbol for physical touch sometimes. And you're speaking very eloquently to what happens in a meeting, but we need a culture change. And my fear is that we learn how to do meetings, but we don't know how to do the culture change. That means each person on the street is minimally competent at addressing other people who would differ from themselves.
Yeah, but there are events. So I remember going to Congo Square Market, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we had the farmer's market, and it's predominantly white. And then they've built a market, started a market, Congo mm-hmm. Square Market, during the summer. And, you know, that's in the South Side. And, you know, a lot of the people from Fall Creek don't know it exists.
Right.
And so sometimes it's just going to, you know, mm-hmm. outside your comfort mm-hmm. zone, to places where you find a higher percentage of people of color versus, you know, your safe zone of, and just going to social events.
Right.
And my experience has been, of the last couple of years, is just showing up and being there. And over time, it breaks down the us versus them.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that, you know, you asked for the solution to this, and this cultural part is one piece. And the other piece, though, is the built environment.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's really important to say this, is that we sometimes swing, right? So we went through a period of time where we didn't do much. There was a lot of holding back the built environment here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what I don't want to see is this constant extreme swing
right.
back and forth. Well, that wasn't a solution, so we're going to swing the other extreme and do like a ton of big
right.
development and, you know, give tons of abatements.
Right.
And, you know, that's an extreme
right.
too. And I'm not
saying that's
what we're doing. But
we can't go from being a gated county, which we've functionally been a gated county for 30 years, because we haven't allowed the people who need to work here to live here.
That's the piece.
And now we can't just throw the gates open and let anything come in, but we also have to engage the people who live outside or the people who would take the new jobs that are being created, because we're an island of affluence in a sea of poverty.
Yes.
And we have to recognize that. And the sea of poverty is much worse just outside the town borders of the county than it is even within the
Well, and we also can recognize that we're kind of crumbling on the inside,
too,
you know, because the middle class is getting a lot of pressure because geographically the city is isolated.
And we're getting old.
Right.
And we're getting, as a population, right. even though we have lots of students.
Exactly. So, you know, at least for me, one of the things that I have been saying, you know, over the last 5 weeks, people have heard me say this, but I do actually believe I am a researcher. We have a project that was started with that is done. Mm-hmm. That all these amazing experts that were very excited about it with grant funding built the form-based code for Ithaca. Mm-hmm. And the idea of it was, and if anybody researches form-based codes throughout the country, I was talking to someone recently about the Boston Harbor. Mm-hmm. Same thing. The idea is you don't let every plot, you know, sell off every plot and the developer does whatever they want with it and you get, you know, this patchwork city where nothing relates to anything else and it feels disjointed and mm-hmm. you don't have a plan. What a form-based code is the creation of a plan for the city so that you can keep a feel. You can mm-hmm. you can encourage the vibrancy. You can encourage pedestrian walk, you know, the walkability. Mm-hmm. Okay. You can really incorporate the roads into a vision and the types of developments. And what was identified is that we have over 1 million square feet of undeveloped and underdeveloped land inside the city limits. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the question is, how do we encourage moderate development? Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean something that still feels like people could sit on the stoop and engage with each other. Something that is to scale, human scale, so that it's you don't feel like ants in an anthill.
Right. And brings us up to the point where we would be ecologically in balance with the region, which would be an increase of 20% to 30% in population.
And we could create the housing that we need, but we could also create diversity in housing. We would be supporting the smaller developers, encouraging that type of development, supporting banks and supporting them in doing that. And we would start to create, you know, the opportunities for homeowner options, creation of homeowner options rather than just rentals or senior housing or affordable housing being mixed right. in the same development areas.
And I want to just toss out another piece here. We have between 10 and 20,000 bedrooms that are likely not used on any given night. So we have a lot of built environment already in place. But because we're relatively affluent, even though we pay high taxes, we have these spaces that aren't used for what they were intended for. So we need a kind of a cultural conversation about what are our real needs for privacy and personal space, and what would be a more responsible use of the mm-hmm, environment, mm-hmm. and how could we change the code to make those spaces available to people right. who could use them.
And you said something that I really liked earlier, which is bringing people to the table who need, you know, people who want those homes, they should be at the conversation.
Here.
Well, if they want to live here, people who work here,
right.
who want to live here, but currently can't afford to live here, what are they looking for? What are we looking for? And are we having a conversation right. together? I'm a community organizer.
Right.
I'm always going to come from that perspective because it's very instinct to me to say, you know, we have a problem to fix. Let's not impose it on people. And then, you know, after the quote unquote solution has been created, everybody needs to adjust around it.
Right. And that's going to be tricky in part because to bring the people to the table, a lot of times you're dealing with classism, because the middle to lower class, working class whites are the ones who've been driven out disproportionately in this time of development, and,
right.
And as well as the minority population, which is disproportionately poor.
Right.
When I was here as an undergraduate in '76, a person could live in College Town and rent an apartment and work as a support staff person at Cornell. In the mid-1980s, they needed to live somewhere in the town, further in the city of Ithaca or the town of Ithaca. By the 1990s, they needed to be moving out to the outer townships.
Right.
And by the 2000s, they need to be out of the county.
Right.
It's not affordable.
Right, right. And what I'm seeing happening in Fall Creek right now, you know, as I said, a lot of families on fixed incomes, mm-hmm. you know, can't Or you know, the people who have retired.
Half
can't
of my neighbors
to.
Who've retired on Aurora Street, on the 800 block of Aurora Street, have left either left the county or at least left the city. But many of them have even left the state. And the houses have turned over at tremendously for us inflated rates. And the block went from having a significant African American population to having almost none. And now we have, now we're building it back slowly.
Right.
And partly because I rent to persons of color in right. my house. But it's, we have a lot of issues.
Yeah.
And they're really deep and complicated.
And there isn't one solution for everything. It's messy. And I think the one last thing that I would say about this is we can't solve it overnight. And we may need to be okay with messy.
We may learn how to, and this is a phrase that I'm using more, how to live with a certain amount of virtue in the midst of the conflict.
Yeah.
And that's messy, but there's also a way to be, if the we know when a fight is worthwhile.
Well, the fact that we're talking about it.
We're not damaging each other. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so let's.
It's a good thing.
Yes, yes, yes. The question that I usually end the show with, that I always end the show with, is almost always, is what do you do to take care of yourself when you feel like your life is coming out of balance? What do you do intellectually, emotionally, physically, daily, weekly, monthly, you know, from time to time? And how do you know when you need to do it? I mean, that's the whole plate. But pick a piece and start, and we'll see where it goes.
There are a lot of little things that I do. My family is here, and that is part of a reason I moved back
to
Ithaca.
Your family of origin?
My family, yeah. My mother, my father, my sister, her husband, my godparents. I have two sets of godparents. I grew up in a very tight community of maybe 50, 60 families. That sounds funny.
I grew
wonderful.
Up in a similar, in a congregation that was 50 or 60 families, and that's... was tight. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I have really like 12 aunts and 15, you know, uncles and like call them moms. So when I'm feeling out of balance, I take time to be with my family. We break bread, you know, and come together at my godparents' house, sitting at the marina with my mother watching the sunset. Having profound conversations with her. She's a therapist, an amazing, amazing, amazing woman, amazing therapist, because she's so, her soul is old, you know, she's just a very wise woman. And she doesn't ever enable me. You know, it's always truth seeking. It's always about reflection, and it's always about my well-being, recognizing that my journey is still, you know, for all of us, is finding our place in the world.
Right. And the world is not us. It's bigger than us.
Right. Yeah. And am I aligned with my own truth and why I'm here and what I want to do? So that voice has been internalized, you know, so when I'm feeling off, when I'm feeling scattered, when I'm feeling like I'm spinning, sometimes, you know, the world will tell me I'll injure myself. You know, I'll hurt something because I'm pushing too hard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I'm a very driven person.
I fell and... on the subway in New York City, and they had this friction paint, and I ripped a gaping hole in my knee because I wasn't balanced. My life was going too fast, and I was rushing too much. I knew exactly what you mean.
And it's always the message to me is slow down, slow down, and start asking the question again: are you happy? Are you aligned with who you want to be? Are you aligned with who you are? And those questions bring me back to, it's like, you know, a jolt. Oh, right. Am I happy? Have I gone down a path so far that, you know, I'm losing sense of who I am? And am I doing it because I think I should? Mm-hmm. Or am I doing it because I want to and because it's aligned, you know, with what I'm feeling drawn to do?
Right.
And so those internal questions are almost daily. Sometimes I lose them and then I come back to them. And then sometimes it's a little, you know, more difficult to get back on track because you've put things in motion and you realize I really need to step back, because at the end of the day, the only thing that matters, you know, when I'm lying on my deathbed is, have I lived my life with integrity, and have I done the things that I want to do, and do I like who I am? you know, and so maybe that's a, in a way, a selfish way of looking, saying at the end of the day, that's the person you are the most responsible to. So I do look at that person, put myself in that bed and say, what am I going to feel, you know, and then bring that back to the person that I am. So, as far as just physical things, I, when I'm feeling out of center, trying to go home and go to bed, get a long night's sleep, going out in nature is really important to me. Exercising is really important to me. It's my meditation. Eating really good food is very, very important to me. So those types of activities, which are just the rituals, getting myself back into rituals. And actually the last is, the last two, extremely good music and dancing helps my body relax. It is another one of my meditations, and reading kids' books. I read kids' books a lot. I've read Harry Potter series like 7 times through. The Percy Jackson series.
Not little kids' books, but kids' books.
There's something beautiful and innocent and fun, and it brings me back to myself in a way that's playful, so that I'm not taking myself so seriously, and that's so important to me.
Now, you had used the term rituals, and a significant number of people have a set schedule, and ritual implies some kind of regularity. Do you have that, or do you tend to just, when you realize you need to do something, you just address it? How do you know how to take care of yourself? Are you one of these people who tries to schedule things, or do you just, well, when do you know you need to do something?
I go by intuition. I do draw lists. I have to-do lists over the place, you know. I go by intuition a lot. I wake up and
whether things feel like they're spinning out of control, which is what you'd say.
I have like 40 plates spinning sometimes, and I am, I'm watching them all. But you know, the lists are actually really important to me. So am I very systematic with my days? You know, that I always do this at this time, this time? Absolutely not. But do I go to bed thinking about what are the things that are going to be of greatest need tomorrow? And I'll do this a lot on my phone before I go to bed. Before I put it in airplane mode, I'll type a note to myself. This is your list for tomorrow. And then I will follow that list. And then sometimes emergencies will come up and other things will need to, but I will always know then I didn't get to that list. I'll add to that and that'll become the next day's list. Actually, you know, that's my lifeline of how I keep centered and focused on the actions of what I need to do.
Anna, it's been really good to get to know you.
It's been wonderful. Thank you.
We're going to close with Driftwood and The Sun Is Going Down. Do you want to say anything about it or just play it?
I fall in love with music, and then I'll fall in love with it even more, and it'll become a core of the music I listen to when I fall in love with the people. And these people of this band are exceptional people. I just like them, and the music is fun, and they are precise musicians. They're amazing and fun. So yeah, this is one of their songs that keeps my nephew and niece circling and dancing and screaming and laughing around me, and I will always have that image of them playing with me listening to this song. So it's one of theirs that I love.
So here we go.
Where I go, who I know I see. I'm not one for nostalgia or the changing of scenes. Where I go, who I know I see. And I'm stubborn and lame and not about to change. No kind of lifestyle for no kind of dame. I know what I am and I know what I want. Well, the sun's going down, so if you want me around, then if you want me, I'll be right here. Oh, you know where I am, and you know where I stand. The sun's going down, so if you want me around, then if you want me, I'll be right here. Oh, you know where I am, and you know where I stand.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report.